Wie Bob Dean.
I am the concept of Bob Darrell, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm sober only through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in, that I've accessed and maintained in my life through a process outlined in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, the ability to remain reasonably sponsorable, and a persistent and consistent effort in the actions of self-reduction and helping God's kids. And consequently, I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion-altering substance since October 31st, 1978. And that is the big miracle in my life. I'm delighted. I'd like to just have 50 copies of his introduction. Can we do that? Mandatory listening for all, most of my sponsees. I am delighted to be here. This convention's meant a lot to me over the years. This is my fourth time here, third time as a speaker. I can't come here without trying to look through the audience to see where John Holmes is. He was such a dear, dear part of my sobriety. The one time I came here and I wasn't a speaker, I was in one of the worst years of my sobriety, in my 11th year, and I'd been in a relationship for 6 years, married for 4 and a half, a 2-year-old daughter, and got a divorce that I didn't understand why I was getting. And the day after the divorce was finalized, my wife and little girl moved in with my sponsee and very best friend. And all of a sudden I knew why I was getting a divorce. And I was crazy for a period and came down here and stayed at John's house in Lilburn. And it was happened to be when the Atlanta Roundup was going on, and came here 1 year. And it was very good for me. So this conference has a place in my heart. I have a lot of old friends here. John came from Brazil. I mean, wow. And Kathy and John Shires. And I know I've grown spiritually because I can admit to people today that John's my friend. I mean, I couldn't. There was a time when I would have been afraid of what you thought. But I can. It's okay. I'm good with it now. And Jerry and those of us that know Jerry, we know that Maggie's a saint to have been married to him for that long. I mean, Jesus. I miss John. You know, he would do something. He sponsored you. When he would get real serious, he'd go like this with his nose, right? And I just want to tell you, I love John Holmes. I'm missing. I'd like to welcome our new people. I'm glad you're here. Especially the guy got the book. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is not church. This is not Amway. This is not therapy. This is different. This is the only place I know of that you'll get a gift and a standing ovation for recently burning your life to the ground. You won't get that at the PTA, I'll tell you. Welcome. I'm excited for the new people because I know something you don't know. I know what can happen to you here beyond anything you can imagine. Not only don't you know what can happen, if you could have gotten a vision of it, you wouldn't believe it. It's beyond our wildest dreams. I have a bad case of alcoholism. I suspect I had it before I picked up a drink because I was a bit odd as a kid. I came from a wonderful family. I mean, I was really, my mother and father were just wonderful people. They loved me. They sacrificed for me. I mean, if nurture had to do with alcoholism, I wouldn't be an alcoholic. But I don't think it had anything to do with how I was raised and the family I was in. And I think I was just born with a thirst and a hunger, born with an exaggerated sense of incompleteness that I could never really put my finger on. It's just, there was always just something wasn't quite right with me. I couldn't have told you about it, but I don't really feel like other people look. There's an awkwardness about me. It was way before I ever picked up a drink. In grade school, there was just this awkwardness about me. I didn't know how to connect with the way other people seemed to be connected and a part of. So I did what a lot of guys like me do, because I know this from sponsoring people. I became the pretend person, the person it talks about in chapter 6 who, when it says, more than most, the alcoholic lives the double life. I created a facade, a stage character. I started becoming the guy who pretended he wasn't afraid, and I was afraid a lot. I became the guy who pretended he fit, and the truth was, I don't really. I became the guy who pretended he was okay, and I'm not. And I cowered behind the facade with the fear that some guy's going to realize, he's going to pull my whole card and find, expose me to everybody that I am not cool, I am not tough, and I do not fit, and I am scared to death. And I cowered with that feeling of being found out. And I'll tell you, about the time I was 12, almost 13 years old, when I took the first drink, I think I needed one for years. Oh, I'll tell you something, you don't even know that you're feeling bad until you finally feel good and you went, oh my God, I was feeling bad. You don't even know that you were feeling bad until you feel good. And it was amazing. The first time I ever got lit up, it set me free. All of a sudden, I don't have to pretend anymore. I don't have to pretend I was cool. You get me half drunk, man, I am cool. I mean, I'm really cool. I don't have to pretend I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid when you get me half lit up. I don't have to pretend I fit. I'm your leader. Right? I mean, it just didn't take me to normalcy. It took me to super normalcy. I mean, it was amazing, man. I loved it. Oh, in those early days, in the days when alcohol did that thing for me, the days when the hook was set, the days when the magic was still there, it was amazing. I'd get half drunk, go to a dance, and I can't dance. You get me half drunk, the rhythm of the universe flows through me. I mean, I got moves that blow my mind. I mean, I'm like, wow, how does that happen? I get about half drunk, get in that zone in a pool. I used to hang out in a pool hall. Get in that zone, and man, you get in that zone, can't miss. I'd make shots, I'd blow my mind. I'd think, wow. I could be funny when I'm drinking. Sober, I'm a mope. I'm a depressive mope, man. I'm just serious. Everything heavy. Get me lit up. I crack me up. I'm funny. I could talk to girls when I was drinking. Oh, I can't talk to girls. I don't want to be crude, but I swear to God, I'm sure if it wasn't for alcohol, I'd be celibate to this day. I mean, I could, because I was so insecure. I couldn't even talk to girls. But man, all that falls off of me when I drink. It's spectacular. I loved it. Well, I got a progressive illness. The book says I didn't know that for some time, but I did notice something. I just noticed that as the years went by, my ability to get that magical effect seemed to bleed out some, seemed to diminish some. Now, I don't know, it's probably because I'm drinking that. If I drink this and take a couple of those and then smoke a little of that, maybe I'll keep this thing going, you know, I'll keep it going. And I started, everybody in my generation at some time or other, we started, because the progression of the disease, the fun's running out of the drink, and so the magic's bleeding out, so I'm trying to throw other things in the mix to jumpstart the party in a futile attempt. And I am an alcoholic. Let me tell you something. Alcoholics should not do drugs. It's bad. Oh, no. I'm telling you, it's bad. We do them alcoholically. It's really bad. One of my favorite songwriters has a song, and he says, you can get what's second best, you just can't get enough. And so I was chasing something that I found in a bottle of 151 rum. I'm chasing that thing. I can't get it. And I'm frantic, and the years went on. I'd be drinking some guy's house sometime, sitting in the basement, drinking wine, smoking a little reefer. The bottle of wine would be dead. He don't have no more. Well, that's not good. Because I'm the kind of guy, once I start drinking, if I'm still conscious, I ain't done drinking. You know what I'm saying? So if I can't get any, and sometimes this would happen on a Sunday in Pennsylvania, that's really bad. Because there's nothing open. And so I'm the guy, you put me in a spot like that where I started drinking, and I all of a sudden it's done. I'm going to go to your medicine cabinet, and I'm just going to take whatever I find in there. I don't even know what it is half the time. I took stuff that had me up for a day and a half talking about the same thing over and over again real fast. I took some stuff, turned my legs into rubber. I'd start falling around, bouncing off the walls. Man, one time I got over regular. Ooh. I ate all the pills off some wheel one time and found out later there's no chance I'll be pregnant in my lifetime. Well, why am I doing that? Because I'm a pill head? No, I'm doing that because I'm an alcoholic and the party's bleeding out and I'm desperate to jumpstart and get back to those good old days. And I can't get back there. And I don't know what's wrong with me. And as the fun's bleeding out, the problems are kind of increasing. And it's getting rough. I'm starting to get into a lot of trouble because I'm more and more desperate and I'm doing crazier things. And I start entering into a phase where sometimes I drink and I go out and have fun, be the life of the party. Other times I drink and I just go on a crying jag. Sometimes I get violent. Man, I'm not a violent guy. I don't want to be that guy. But sometimes I get drunk and these uncontrollable emotions are just come out of me, and I was losing control of my life. And how does that happen? Because alcohol gave me control of my life at one time, and now it's turning on me. And I don't know, understand what's going on here, but it ain't good. It's getting frightening here. Started getting in a lot of trouble. I started getting arrested. Nothing braggable, really. I fancied myself at one time a gangster. The police told me I was a public nuisance. I get arrested for stuff you don't even want to tell anybody in a jail cell. And what'd you get arrested for? I killed a cop. What about you, kid? I peed behind a building. Oh, my God. Some woman went to the bathroom in the bar and I stole her purse. Ooh, it's embarrassing. Right? It's embarrassing. And so I started getting in more and more trouble. I was a blackout drinker. I was a blackout drinker for years and didn't know I was a blackout drinker. I was in my first treatment center. Guy said, asked everybody the question. And he says, anybody here have blackouts? No. He said, you never had a blackout? I said, I don't remember any blackouts. He says, that's why they call them blackouts. I had a lot of blackouts. I can't tell. I had so many times where I could lose my car. I lived in Pennsylvania. In Pennsylvania, there's a whole bunch of towns that run together. You know, so it was not unusual. You'd start drinking in a bar in one little town and end up five towns over, and your car is somewhere in there. Because, you know, you don't know where. Because you were at a bar and went with some people, and you don't know where your car... Oh, that's a terrible thing. Oh, God. And as the disease progressed, my behavior in blackouts started becoming more and more bizarre. And you know, what is... there's this, maybe they're untreated Al-Anons. Those people that just wait to tell you what you did the night before. What is that? That's some kind of sadistic, ooh. They just can't wait to tell you. And it's never good. Nobody ever came up to me the next day and said, oh, Bob, you were so helpful last night. No, I don't get that. I get you peed in our kitchen is what I get. I get you threw up in my living room. You broke my lamp. You sideswiped my car. You passed out my front lawn. You stole my stash. You hit on my wife. The very worst one. Some guy cornered me. I had the shakes, man. I was on my way to that state liquor store waiting for them to open. Need getting a bottle of Richard's Wild Irish Rose, man. I'm sick, need that drink. And the guy corners me and says, you know, you told everybody last night you beat Bruce Lee in a karate match. Shoot me. Just shoot me. Right? And so now I'm doing things when I'm drinking that horrify me, that fuel my drinking, and I drink more and do more bizarre things. So I'm drinking over my drinking now. This is really a bad deal. And I don't know what's wrong with me. My poor mother and father took the worst of it, I suppose. I really had a terrible, terrible view of the world and how evil and terrible it was and mean it was. But the truth was, there was an awful lot of people that went really a long distance for me that I would, if the tables were turned, I never would have done that for them. Bosses that gave me chance after chance, I would have, I'd have never done that. Girlfriends that took me back, and running partners that would give me another chance after I did something just disgusting and really embarrassing, you know. And as the disease progressed, it seemed like I got lonelier and lonelier for two reasons. And it's not just the fact that I'm burning people out and they're just turning and going away from me. Now, that's a piece of it. But also, alcohol at one time, one of the great things of the magical effect is it took away the loneliness of my abstinence and connected me to people. And as the disease progressed, the ability to get connected and be a part of and feel one with seemed to bleed out the most. And alcoholism became very, very lonely for me, drunk or sober. In the last several years, I pretty much wanted to just drink alone, because I never knew what I was going to do. I mean, I don't know if I'm going to be okay and be a little bit of fun, or if I'm going to be morose and just in crying and just or violent or just, I don't know what I'm going to do. I can't trust my behavior. And I don't want anybody to see me like this. So my idea of drinking the last few years was just to hole up somewhere with a half gallon of vodka or a gallon of Richard's Wild Irish Rose and just seek oblivion. In the last few years, that was all there was in the bottle for me. There was no more party. There was no more freedom. There was no more connectedness. There was no more rock and roll. There was none of that. It was just pathetic. The last few years of my drinking, I'm not the guy that's playing music with a bunch of guys and shooting pool with my buddies and talking to the girl. I'm not that guy. I want to be that guy. I'd have given anything to be that guy again. But once alcohol turns on you, man, you can't turn it back. There have been millions of cases of guys like me died trying to jumpstart a party that's dead and cannot be jumpstarted. And we don't want to believe it because, if that's true, then what's there to live for? See, in our book, it says something that was so true for me. And it says that for a while you go on and you can't imagine life without it because it's cool. And it's the only real freedom I get. And then it says you get to a point later, as you get a little sicker, where you can't imagine life with it or without it. And that's because now when I drink, it's pathetic. It doesn't free me. Matter of fact, it makes me more narcissistically self-involved and depressed, and more lonely, more pathetic. The last couple of years, I, If I was staying on your couch or something in the middle of the night, I might be on your phone calling people I went to grade school with. I remember calling an ex-girlfriend and crying into the phone, "We should have got married," until her husband got on the phone and threatened me, you know. Jesus. I mean, this is not a party. I don't bathe anymore. Because I'm busy, I guess. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know why I don't bathe. I think maybe I just don't care. I don't know. I was just an obsessive oblivion seeker, because that's all that was left, was just to blot me out. The book says something that's, God, it's such a painful thing, line, but it's so true. It says, we had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out our intolerable situation as best we could, or seek spiritual help. What kind of spiritual help? You're creeping me out with this spiritual help thing. Spiritual help. Now, the truth is, I opted for one. Not two. If I could have went on to the bitter end, blotting out my intolerable situation, I would have done that. One of the worst things about alcoholism is whether you want to or not, you're forced intermittently into abstinence. Whether you want to or not. And that was the... If I could have just stayed in oblivion until it eventually killed me, I'd sign up for that. But I was intermittently being forced into abstinence. And in abstinence, it's actually worse. Because there's no anesthetic. See, my drinking got bad, that when I drink, the memory of the remorse and the guilt and the shame and all the things I did that I hate myself for, I can't really drink it away, but at least I could numb myself to it and eventually hit oblivion. But sober, oh, it just all waits for me. It's just all there. It's terrible. And every time I get sober, I end up full of fear to a point. I'm one of those kind of guys, I'm a worrier. I don't mean to be, but I'm just obsessed with checking my future, and I never have checked it and it looked good. You know, I'm not a hope seeker. My mind works like a problem seeking missile. It just you know, I to this day, if I'm having a bad spiritual hair day, it does that today. On a good spiritual hair day, I don't listen to it. It's like music in the doctor's office, blah, blah, blah. I don't even pay attention to it. But on a bad spiritual hair day, when it's right here, I can walk into a room of strangers and just, oh, I can see some of you are going to be a problem. That guy from Nashville, he's judging me, I can tell. Yeah. Yeah, and I just see problems. And I'm always solving them, which it's funny. Do you ever, when you have problems with people, it's a weird thing. When you think whether it could be a job, it could be an AA, it could be anywhere, and you think you have a problem with someone, and then you start sort of approaching them like they're problematic. It's funny how they become problematic after a while. It's a bad dynamic. And so I see problems everywhere. Wilson talks about that in 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. He says we talk a lot about problems. And then he said, I think this is funny. He says, well, that's because we're problem people. I have a friend who says he's a golf person. He just thinks and does it. Golf's his deal. Well, problems are my deal. And I'm always solving problems that haven't occurred yet, but I'm glad I'm catching them before they actually become a problem. Yep. And what happens to me is I just angst up on all this anxiety and worry about all these problems that don't even exist until I'm overwhelmed with them, and then I kind of implode into a deep depression. a depression that I can't, that's just brutal, brutal, brutal. And I, you know, in a psychiatrist's office again, clinically depressed. I remember I was in a halfway house one time up in Newcastle, and I'm sober, I don't know, a couple months, I guess, I don't know. I'm not doing well. I don't do well sober. I don't. And the guy who ran the place, he was concerned about me. He was a nice guy, and he made me an appointment with a psychiatrist because I guess I looked depressed. Well, it's not that I'm depressed. I just ponder my life a lot. You know, I'm always studying myself, and it never turns out well. And so he sends me to this psychiatrist, and I remember I'm going in there, and I'm sitting in the waiting room, and I'm thinking, man, I don't want to drink again, and I know it's coming, man. I'm going, because I know, you know, I've been down this road. It's not like my first time. It's not my first rodeo, and I get it that eventually, the way I feel, I'm going to drink. And I thought, well, maybe this guy can help me, you know. I'm going to really try to be honest with this man, and maybe he's a psychiatrist. I know I went to other ones, but maybe this is a good one. And I went in and I sat down. He said, tell me about yourself. And I started talking, just whatever's on my mind. And I was telling him about the halfway house and how that, you know, they don't really treat me very well there. And you know, I got stuck washing the pots and pans. And I got this dumb job. I'm working as a painter on a crew of painting a school system. And the guys there are all like clicky and best friends, and none of them will have anything to do with me. They don't like me. They won't even ask me. They asked me to go with them a couple times, and when I told them I couldn't go because I don't drink, it's like I think they're making fun of me. And they don't appreciate, you know, I'm sober. I'm trying here, man, I'm trying. And they're tempting me with stuff. And I'm telling this psychiatrist that, and I can't get a good job because I had a good job. I burned it to the ground. I can't get a good job, so I'm painting. And he says to me, he says, you know, those people that you work with, they don't really appreciate the heroic effort you're making here not drinking. Oh, I just kind of started to like that guy. You know what I'm saying? I mean, And he said, there's no reason for you to have to emotionally react to things like that. He said, we got this new medication, and it's just for guys like you trying to stay sober. And he's reaching for his prescription pad, and I'm starting to feel better just watching him reach for the prescription pad. He didn't give me nothing yet, you know, I'm just... Now, here's a man who understands. See, one of the things I don't understand, I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous and in and out of rehabs for a number of years, and I took a tremendous beating and a tremendous failure to finally understand that I have that abnormal reaction to alcohol. Because I didn't want to have it. But I get it. I get it after failure after failure, that if I pick up a drink, something happens to me and I can't stop. I get it. But what I didn't understand, and it would almost kill me, is not only do I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol, is I have an abnormal reaction to abstinence. And that's what makes alcoholism for me chronic. The problem looks like it's alcohol, but what alcohol really is was a medicine that no longer works and has turned on me and starting to do things to me when it used to do something for me. And I don't get it because it's the only effective medicine I've ever known. And now, every time I get sober, the problem is no longer the alcohol. What the problem is abstinence. See, I get sober. And Silkworth says it pretty well. He says, guys like me, we quit drinking. He says, well, if you've got the symptoms are three things. He says, the first thing is we become restless. And we all know that, don't we? You know, that it's a vague restlessness. It's just a feeling as if I can't really get settled anywhere. It's a feeling or a sense, wherever I am, I need to be somewhere else. And I don't know where that is, but it's not here. I'm like that dog circling the living room looking for its spot to lie down that can't find its spot. I'm restless. The second symptom he talks about is irritability. Well, I am not irritable because irritable people irritate me. But for God's sakes, every time I quit drinking, I just start seeing how stupid everybody is. It's a gift, I guess. I don't know. Everywhere I go, there's stupid people. Oh, my God. Oh, we go to work. There's stupid people at work. They were nice when I got the job. Now I can see there's stupid people. Stupid people in traffic. There's stupid people in the grocery store. Oh, AA, they got them grouped right here. I got all the stupid people in AA. Oh my God, it's like AA is intellectually offensive to me. I mean, I'd worked as a counselor, for God's sakes. My mom was a therapist. AA, it's just, it's creepy. It's creepy stupid. I mean, you don't even talk English. It's like, you just said, first things first, easy does it, live and let live. I felt like I'm being stoned to death by refrigerator magnets from a recovery bookstore. Live and let live, easy does it. Stop it. Stop. Just stop it, would you? Oh, my God. Oh, and then you're grateful. You're grateful for everything. Oh, I'm just grateful. I'm grateful, grateful, grateful. I'm sitting in a halfway house. In Pennsylvania, the Ark House, I've burnt my life to the ground. And I listen to an endless line of people from AA come in and tell me how wonderful their life is and how grateful they are. And I just thought, I've died and gone to hell. This is horrible. Isn't it bad enough? I burnt my life to the ground. You want to rub my face in how wonderful you are, for God's sakes? Grateful for everything. I don't like anything. I don't even like me. I hate me. I loathe me secretly. I mean, for God's sakes, it makes perfect sense. If someone else would have done to my loved ones and family what I did to them, I'd want to kill them. Is it any wonder I end up loathing myself? I'll tell you something, it's pretty hard to save your own life when you secretly hate yourself. Oh, my God, grateful. Oh, then, God, you love everybody. Oh, Jesus. Oh, just, I hate this. Oh, God, I'd be just depressed, and I don't feel good, and I just want to be left alone. And somebody in AA would come up to me, and they go, has anyone told you they loved you today? I never know how to answer that. I don't... So I just say no, and they give you a big hug. Oh, I love you. I just want to scream at them. Don't touch me. Just leave me alone. Oh, creepy, creepy people. Oh, you got nothing for me. I mean, I came to a conclusion. I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm going to a lot of psychiatrists over the years. I don't know what's wrong with me, but I'll know one thing. Whatever's wrong with me is not the same thing that's wrong with you. Because you quit drinking, and look at you. You're wonderful. I hate you for it, but you're wonderful. I quit drinking. I'm depressed. I don't fit anywhere. I'm restless, irritable. And Silkworth says, discontent. What is that? I'm chronically malcontent. And I get sober, and there's just something horridly missing inside of me, and I don't know what it is, and I'm tracking life looking for it, and I target stuff. You know, I get that job in that J&L Steel, man. I get a job, I get working there, man. That's have a boat, own a house, have a Harley kind of money. And you know what that's like, and then I get that job, man. I'm not there very long, and man, they're taking advantage of me, and just stupid people. Meet that girl, you think, oh my God. God, if I was with her, I'd be there. She'd complete me. And I get with her, and after about 3 weeks, was I wrong about her? Ooh, man. What is it about me? No matter how good something is I bring into my life, the shine just wears off of it, and I don't understand what's happening. I was 10 years sober, and I'm working with a guy at the state penitentiary, and he said something to me, and the veil lifted, and I knew exactly. It made perfect sense why the shine wears off of everything I bring into my life, no matter how good it is. I started to realize that unconsciously, on an emotional level, I started to compare what it felt like to have that job to what it felt like to have 5 shots of tequila. Now I don't want the job anymore. It's let me down. I start comparing to what it's like being loved by this girl to what it's like to drink a pint of 151 rum with my buddies, and now she aggravates me. And I don't even know I'm doing that. But it's almost as if this magical effect in the early days from alcohol, it just ruined me and spoiled me. And it became the paramount thing in my life. And everything in life, I compare against it, and it all falls short. Because I got a spiritual sickness, and that was the only thing that ever seemed to heal that temporarily. And it did. I know, if you're new here, you think I should be up here bad rapping alcohol. I'm not going to bad rap alcohol. Alcohol was amazing for a few years. If you had an old plow horse that couldn't pull the plow anymore, you just put it out the pasture. You don't talk crap about it. And my plow horse couldn't pull the plow no more, that's all. But there was a time when it was spectacular. I remember I worked in this factory. Man, I hated that job. And I couldn't drink there because I drank there one time and they caught me. And they were watching me. And I can't lose. If I drink again there, I'll lose the job. And I can't lose this job because I need that paycheck. Because without that paycheck, there's no medicine. Got to have this job. So I go there every day and I just grind away inside myself that 8 hours. Just, oh God, I hate it. I hate the factory. I hate where the work. I hate the people there. Oh my God, they're clicky. Just stupid hate. Oh God, can't stand them. I'd get to that end of that shift, that buzzer go off. I'd be the first guy at that time clock. And I'm like an arrow shot across the street to that bar. That bartender knows me. I'm in there every night. He's got two doubles set up for me. So as soon as he sees me, he pours me 2 doubles, 100 proof, and a beer. And I throw that first double down. You know, did you ever notice that first drink tastes like hope? Doesn't it? Yeah. It's like hope. And I throw that second one down. Now he's setting me up 2 more and I'm sipping on that beer. Now some of these guys I can't stand that I'm working from in that factory with are coming into that bar. And I got 4 shots of 100 proof Southern Comfort in me and a half a beer. And they're walking in and I'm looking at them thinking, you know, they're not bad people. A couple more double shots, I'm shooting pool with a couple of them. A couple more shots later, we're planning our vacations together. About 15 double shots in, I'm saying things like, I'll die for you, man. You know, I love you. You know, just, oh. I mean, I feel spiritually connected. I feel love. I feel intimacy. And for a guy who's on the natch, doesn't have none of that, that's the closest to heaven a guy like me ever gets. That's a spiritual remedy for a spiritual sickness. Because when I walked into that bar, I was depressed and disconnected, and my spirit was sick. It was full of me. And a few shots of whiskey, and I started to get free. And I loved that. I'll tell you something, if alcohol could do that for me to this day, I'd probably still drink it. I didn't get sober because I was anti-alcohol. I got sober because I bled every ounce of remedy out of the medicine until there was absolutely, absolutely nothing left. I remember It had turned on me for about 2 years and I couldn't accept it. I didn't want to accept it because if what is happening to me is an all-time reality, I can't live with this. If this is it. And then about the last year, I guess, somewhere in there, I remember I went on this one drunk. I was in this place in Pennsylvania, and I busted out of there and went on a drunk with a buddy of mine I'd been in detox with. And he took me to this bar, and I'm excited to be there because I've been over sober for a few months now. I mean, it was just, you know, sobriety to me feels like I'm doing time, and it's not good. And I'm putting up with it, but I'm over ready to get free, and I'm excited. And did you ever notice if you're in the last stages of alcoholism, the best part of every drunk is the hour before it starts. The anticipation is spectacular, and I'm excited. I'm going to this bar, and it's a great bar, and I'm in there, and I order a double shot, throw it down, waiting for that. Because I'm in that bar watching people having a good time. I'm watching guys shooting pool and laughing and dancing with the girls. And oh man, I want that so. In my lonely, depressed state, I want that so bad I can taste it. The problem is I throw another one down and the only thing that jump starts in me is not the freedom. It is not the party. It is just the phenomenon of craving. And as I'm starting to move into a little bit of rumminess, I remember looking out at the people having a good time, and it just broke my heart because it was like a veil lifted and I could see the truth, and it was a bitter truth, a truth I couldn't live with. That, Bob, you can drink this stuff until it kills you, but this depressive, lonely, pathetic drinking is as good as it gets for you. And all of a sudden, I knew the truth. And I'll tell you something, not too long after that, I tried to take my own life. And that's a story unto itself. That same year, I ended up in an emergency room. And I used to end up in emergency rooms a lot because I hurt myself sometimes. I'm an idiot. I fall down. This particular time, I put my fist through a window and they had to stitch. I couldn't stop bleeding. They had to take me to the hospital. They stitched me up and they gave me some x-rays. And I'm sitting in the waiting room of the emergency room waiting for the x-rays to come back. And so I've kind of sobered up a little bit because there's no bars in emergency room waiting rooms. I mean, if you ever needed a drink, you can't get a drink there. So I've kind of sobered up while I'm in there somewhat. And I'm sitting in there and there's a rack of medical pamphlets and diabetes and heart disease, that kind of thing. There's one of them that said 7 warning signs of cancer. So I grabbed that pamphlet, I started looking through it. And one of the warning signs was something like unexplained intermittent bleeding. I read that. Thinking, oh my God, I dry heave and sometimes a little blood comes up. And I thought, there have been a couple occasions I've been bleeding out both ends. I thought, oh my God, I have cancer. I have cancer. And then I thought, oh my God, it's metastasized to my brain. That's why I do weird things and can't remember them. That's why I go off the handle and inappropriately with emotional responses, why I flip out on people. That's why sometimes I get so depressed and withdrawn from life. That's why nobody likes me. I have a brain tumor. Oh, it explained volumes of my life. I thought, oh my God, this, and I started fantasizing about this brain tumor. And you know, one of these days they're going to pick me up from the park, take me to the cancer ward. Well, they're going to diagnose me as terminally ill with a brain tumor. Of course, they're going to have to call my mother and father who thought I was a bum. And they're going to realize how wrong they had been. And they're going to come running to the hospital to beg my forgiveness. And then, of course, all my ex-girlfriends who thought I was a bum, they're going to be notified and they'll come running into the hospital properly ashamed of themselves. And, oh, God, I just loved that fantasy. And then I ended up in a detox. told the doctor, he's trying to give me, testing my vitals and stuff, he's talking about alcoholism. I said, Doc, I have a brain tumor. And he said, he looks at me weird. He says, has this been verified? I said, yes, it has. Well, I mean, it was verified by the smartest guy I know. So he set me up with a whole bunch of tests. They shot me with dye, took pictures of me, did all kinds of stuff. Finally calls me in. I'm waiting for, they're going to have to notify my mom and dad. Wait, he calls me in. He says, we got the test back. He said, you don't have cancer or a brain tumor or anything. You have an ulcer and a hemorrhoid. And I was depressed. I wanted a second opinion. I was like, no, doc, really? No. I mean, I am so egocentric that I would rather be dead from a terminal illness and right and you wrong than to be free. I mean, if you identify with that on any level, you do not have a high mental health quotient. Anyway, the doc said something to me that fueled my suicide. He said, kid, what you have is alcoholism, and if you keep drinking, it's going to kill you. He said, but you're a young kid in your 20s, and might probably take 5 more years. And I came to in the park, and I'd been thrown out of a place, and I was facing what I knew eventually I was going to have to do 2 years in prison. And when Clancy talks about no friendly direction, I mean, not even the bottle. There's no relief anywhere for me. And I'm in that trap I can't spring, where I can't imagine life with it anymore, not like this, and I can't roll it back, and I can't imagine life without it either. The book says you're at the jumping off place. It says you will wish for the end. And I made the decision to kill myself because I thought 5 more years of this? I can't do 5 more weeks of this. I made the decision to kill myself. And in the decision was a modicum of relief, of closure, of finality, of I'll get this over with. I went to a bridge in Pittsburgh, and I was standing on this bridge trying to get up enough courage to jump, and there's some railroad tracks on the side of the river down below, about maybe 100 feet, maybe less, I don't know. And this terror gripped me that this wasn't high enough. And that with my luck, maybe I won't die. With my luck, I'll end up in some charity ward, paralyzed from the neck down, and I'm a young guy. I'll lay there for 50 years. I can't even get a drink. And my head will just be working on me and telling me what a worthless piece of crap I am, day in and day out and day in. And members of AA will parade newcomers through the room. I'll hear him say, well, this is what happens to you when you don't work our beautiful 12 steps. And I'm paralyzed. I can't even give him the one finger salute. I mean, little did I know that I was going to come out of that and throw myself into Alcoholics Anonymous. But when you think about it, it's perfect. Makes perfect sense. When drinking is horrible, and not drinking is horrible, and you can't even kill yourself, what the hell's left except Alcoholics Anonymous? It really is the last house on the block. There's nowhere to go here. There's nowhere. I mean, this is it. No, your sponsor's not waiting to refer you somewhere out of here. There's no referral. Matter of fact, all the psychiatrists, I sponsor a couple, all clergy, worked with a few of them, that have drinking problems after they fail at the church and they fail at therapy, they have to come here. It's the last house on the block. This is where everybody has to eventually come. And I got lucky. I ended up... And I wasn't trying to go to Las Vegas. I was actually trying to get to California. I thought if I could get to California, the police wouldn't find me. I could dodge the 2 years. I could live on the beach, maybe in Venice or something. And it'd be warm. I almost froze to death on a couple occasions back east in Pennsylvania in the wintertime. It's tough. It's tough when you're on the streets. And I thought I'd get to California. I didn't get to California. I got to Las Vegas. I was so sick by the time I got there. Because I was not only a full-blown late-stage alcoholic, but I would get almost, within a day or two with the way I drank, I'd get physically addicted to alcohol very quickly. And I get to that point after, you know, in a run for a while, maybe a week or not even 10 days maybe, I get to that point where I can't keep it down. It keeps coming back up on me, and my nerves are shot, and it's a bad, bad place. And I got to that place when I hit Las Vegas where I was so sick, and I can't seem to get unsick. I can't keep enough of this stuff down to get even half well, and I ended up in a detox there where after they cleaned me up and got me well enough to attend the meetings, I met a man named Dick Toussaint who died about a year and a half ago, who was my first sponsor, a man who was God's instrument. I look back over the years, and I tell you something, I think that we are brought together by divine appointment. The people that have been put in my life have been perfect. Perfect. And they bring me everything I need. And this man came into my life, and I listened to him, and he talked about a suicide attempt, and I was with him every bit of the way. And I remember sitting there nodding my head and thinking to myself, oh my God, I'm like him. I'm like him. And I thought, something's happened to him, because I've been watching him. He came in there twice a week, and because of his example, I've been going into places like that twice a week for 36 years, 8 months, I guess, and without fail. And I went up to him and I said, I wanted to ask him to sponsor me, but I was so afraid. I had no self-esteem. I just thought that everybody would throw me away because I would. And so I said to him, I said, would you sponsor me? And if you will, I'll do anything you ask me to do. And he was delighted to sponsor me. And then I discovered that they have a lot of things they want you to do. I mean, a lot of, and none of them seem like a good idea. I mean, no, really. I mean, oh, like to make amends. Oh, he was not a big book technician, but he was big on prayer. We don't care if you don't believe in God. Well, I don't want to pray. I'll feel like a hypocrite. You said you've been a hypocrite all your life. Just pray. You know, there's people in AA, they're good talkers, poor listeners, though. I'll tell you. He started me on the path of making amends to my family and the courts and on and on and on. None of this seemed like a good idea. None of it. And he was obsessed with 12-step work. Oh my God. He was just every time you turn around, who are you helping? Did you go on any, do you have any 12-step work? He wanted me to take meetings back into the detox I just got out of. I mean, I was in there a while. Isn't that enough? I mean, he wanted me to take meetings back in there and try to help the people in there. He wanted me to sign up for the state penitentiary. They were starting a meeting there. I thought, I don't have enough tattoos for that, really. He wanted me to go to a reality house, and he wanted me to go on the 12-step list and help people. Oh, my God. You know, I was a counselor, for God's sakes. My mother, I had a lot of therapy, so I tried to, I told him I'd do anything he wanted me to do, but I had to explain, because so many times these people don't know they're wrong, and you have to explain it to them. So I said to him, I said, well, for God's sakes, I know what you're saying, and I'm not against it, but don't you think I should work on me for a while? And he rears back, he says, work on you? You've done quite enough of that. Stop it. And I thought, well, I have done quite enough of that, haven't I? I thought, oh my God, if I could have fixed myself, I think I'd have fixed myself by now. I mean, I did Gestalt therapy, Primal Screamed, I was hypnotized, I did rational emotive therapy. If it came up on the radar and it looked like it was going to help, I took a run at it. When I come to AA and you say no human power, I go, oh yeah, I get that one. Because I took a run at everything that came up. Every medication, everything. I mean, I took a run at it. And so he said, just go help people. I said, okay. I didn't know that that would save my life. I didn't know, see, that he knew something about me. I didn't know. He knew I was the Bill Wilson type. I was the Clancy type of alcoholic. The people, the guys that have to stay constantly, constantly in action, or else we implode into ourselves. And we we lose any sense of freedom. We only find the freedom in helping others. And I didn't know that. And I started doing that, and I started getting set free. And through the process of all the steps, and it's a package here, I started to get free. It was the GSR, my first service conference, and I'll never forget this. I was only about a year sober. I was a GSR, a bit premature. And I was a co-GSR, and the other guy got drunk, so I ended up GSR early. And I was at this service assembly, and there was a trustee there who said something I'll never forget. They said that they believed that 5% of the fellowship did 95% of the service in 12-step work. And then they said that 5%, as long as they continue through their actions to be a 5%er, they never, ever drink again. And when he said that, after relapsing for all those years, I thought, that's it. I want to be one of those guys. And I was surrounded, my first sponsor, everybody in my home group, we were a group, we were the doers, we were the people. My home group was the group that did all the H&I. My home group was the group that was involved in general service, intergroup service. We were the doers, and I just thought, maybe I'm with the right people. And I tried to remain a 5%er. And I didn't know that was going to be the key to lift me up off of me and free me from my depressive, self-obsessed, narcissistic inclinations. And that's really what happens. Alcohol and Alcoholics Anonymous, in the primary purpose, does for me what alcohol used to do for me. Alcohol would set me free and get me up off of me. And that's what I found in 12-step work in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had a lot of wreckage to clean up and years and years and years of paying back money and years of making amends. And that's all part of the package to make me more useful and more connected and closer to God, closer to you, and more closer to fulfilling my primary purpose. I didn't know that the habits and the structure of Alcoholics Anonymous was going to save my life. I was talking about coming down here in my 11th year. When I went through this divorce, I'll tell you one of the hardest things was that I had legal rights to see my daughter. She was about 2 years old. The problem is I have to go over to pick her up where they're living together, right? My ex-best friend and sponsee and my ex-wife and my daughter, they're all living together. And I can't even describe the knot in the pit of my stomach and thinking about going over to where they live. It just made me crazy. But I my heart ached for my daughter. I was the first human being to ever hold her. I cut her umbilical cords and gave her her first bath, and she cried her first tears out in my arms. And she stole my heart. So I miss her. I feel that heartache. And it became so great I had to walk through the fear of going over there, and I made an appointment to go and pick my daughter up. And I was a nervous wreck, and I went over there, and I pulled up to in front of where they're living, and I get out of the car, and I got this wind blowing through the center of me, and I go up to the door, and I ring the doorbell, and freaking happy couple answers the door. They call Kate, and Kate comes running out, 2 years old, cutest thing you've ever seen. She's just adorable. And I take her by the hand, and we go off to spend the whole day together. I had a bunch of stuff planned. First thing, Steve reminded me, the first thing we went and did, we went to Chuck E. Cheese. Bad pizza. But for about $80, you can win a 10-cent ring. I mean, my daughter was all over that. I mean, she loved that. Just try to throw those balls up over that thing and get them in there. And oh man, oh. So we spent quite a bit of time there eating bad pizza. I didn't get scared by the mouse though. But I would. There was a mouse there. I had this deal set up to take my daughter to this ranch. It was actually owned by the people who had the show Legends in Concert. And one of a very dear friend of mine had kept horses there and was involved in the ranch. And so she set the whole thing up to come and tour and play with all the animals. And they had these little ponies. I think they were like Shetlands or something, real little ones. And my daughter, when she heard that she was going to get to ride ponies, she was ecstatic. She, oh, man, she had little toy pink and purple ponies with, you know, stuff. And she just had, was pony crazy, pony and Minnie Mouse crazy. That was her deal. And so I take her over there, and she's playing with all the animals, and we got to get the they brought a couple, they brought a one of those horses, or ponies, out of the stables, and they set it up for her, and we had to hold her on there, because even though it's a little pony, she's, you know, we had to go walk with her around the corral. She loved it. It was a little scary at first, and then she kind of got into it, and it was very cool. And we were done with the pony, and the guy, the works here, was taking it back to the stable. And so we're sitting on this picnic bench next to the corral, and with my daughter, the woman who has the horses there, my friend, and myself, and my daughter's thirsty. So I said to my friend Julie, I said, would you sit here with Kate? I'll go across the yard, and there was a soda machine next to the stables. I'll go get a couple cans of soda. And so I'm going walking over there to get them. And I got the soda, and I'm coming back across the yard. And as I get close to the picnic table, I hear my friend say to my daughter, Kate, hey, Kate, here comes your daddy. Kate looks at me, looks at Julie, and says, that's not my daddy. Craig's my daddy. Somebody put a knife up under my rib cage and twisted it. But I didn't say nothing because, you know, I learned on those streets, we all learned how to push that stuff down hard enough. I'd learned that. I had made a career of that, not letting anybody know what's going on with me. And I pushed those feelings down, but it's killing me. And I went and I sat there and I was nice and tried to put a smile on my face. And early evening, I had to take my daughter back to the house where they were staying, and I got her in the car. We drive up to the front of where they're living, and I take her by the hand, and I walk her up to the front door, and I give her a big hug, and I ring the doorbell, and the happy couple answers the door, and she jumps into his arms, and they all say goodbye, and I walk back to my car, and I get in my car, and I drive about a block away, and I pull over, and I just come apart at the seams, and I am sitting in the car, and I'm crying, I'm sobbing, and I'm talking to God at the same time, and I'm saying to God, God, I am sorry. I love my daughter, but I can't do this. I'm not big enough. This hurts too much. And it was breaking my heart. I had made the decision because of the pain that I'm going to stop seeing. I won't see her anymore. I can't take this. And I look at the clock on the dashboard, and I said, oh, God, I promised this stupid new guy I would meet him down at the SOS Club and take him to a step study across town. I don't want to meet him. I need to go home and think. But you guys have brainwashed me. Do what you say you're going to do. Show up where you say you're going to show up. Oh, crap, I'm going to be late. So I'm racing across town. I'm not happy about any of this. I get to the SOS Club, he's pacing, he's sitting down in front. I said, get in the car. And he gets in the car. We start driving across town, and he's not even in the car but 2 minutes, and he starts to break down sobbing as he's telling me that the courts have denied him once again the ability to see his kids. I'm looking at him, and I'm thinking, crap. There's only one person that can stop you from seeing your daughter, and that's you, Bob. And I thought, all right, I'm looking at him, and I'm thinking, okay, I'll see her again next week. And then the week after that, and the week after that. My daughter's 27 years old today, and they had gotten married, and it didn't work. The wheels fell off. I was sponsoring him again, and I'm trying to help him save his marriage to my ex-wife, which is... which is bizarre. True bit. That's not dramatic. That was square business. Because I remember one time I was at a game. I was at a game, and him and her and I were cheering my daughter in the stands. I remember driving home and saying to God, I was saying, God, if you let me pick a stepdad for my daughter, from anyone on this planet, I'd pick him. And I meant it. And I'd forgiven him by then. And that's a whole another story involving step four. And I sponsor him to this day. I'll see him Monday night. He'll be at my house Tuesday night. We're doing another step workshop together. He's a good guy. Some of you met him, Craig. He's a good guy. And that new guy that I picked up and took across town to the step study, he thought I was helping him. God worked through him and saved me from making the worst decision of my sobriety. She's my little girl. Over the last 27 years, we've traveled all over the world together. We've scuba dived in New Zealand. We've skied in the Rockies. We've scuba dived in Maui and all the Caribbean. We've taken cruises around Europe. And she's the 20th anniversary of me taking her to Disney World in Orlando. We went back to Orlando this year. And she's my little girl. She's 27, but she's still my little girl. And he saved me. See, God works through the people that he might try to help. I don't know if we ever really help anyone. Maybe all we do in the final analysis is we just open a channel by getting out of ourselves and being willing to, and God comes into the vacancy when we're out of the way and does amazing things. If you don't sponsor anyone, I can say nothing else this weekend, I would encourage you to step up. I run into people all the time who don't, and they have some what to them seems like legitimate reasons. Like not too long ago, I ran into somebody, it's not my niche. What do you mean it's not your niche? We have niches here? What do you mean it's not your niche? It's our primary purpose. What do you mean it's not your niche? Well, it's not my niche. I said, well, why do you say that? Well, I sponsored three people and none of them stayed sober. I always like to tell them the story of Bill Wilson. And December 15th, 1934, Wilson got out of town's hospital, and all he knew was he had to help people. That's all he knew. He didn't know much in God and helping people. That's all he knew. And from December 15th, 1934, to May 10th, 1935, which is barely 5 months, Wilson, before he met Bob, worked with 96 failures. So if you've worked with three that didn't stay sober, I think you got about 93 more to go. I mean, before you can say, maybe it's not my niche. And remember, there's a spiritual principle. You throw enough crap up against the wall, some of it's going to stick. So you don't have to carry a message. You just got to fling some crap. That's all. Just keep flinging. Fling, 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 fling. Just keep flinging. And if you do that, great things will come to pass. And then all of a sudden, the lonely guy that I am, I'll be sitting at a Denny's in the early 80s, and I look around, and I'm in a booth that's all guys I sponsor that I really love. And I don't feel that separateness anymore. And I wonder, how did that happen? I guess it happened because I followed your direction. And I persisted. The book says, if you persist, remarkable things will happen. Persist. Where else are you going to go? You can't leave here. It's like the mafia. Nobody leaves here alive. You can't leave here. No, you can't leave. You can't leave. You might just settle in. Buckle in. Stay here. I had a guy recently said to me, he said, I'm done. I'm never coming to AA again. I said, oh yeah, you will. He said, listen to me. I'm never coming to another meeting again. I said, yes, you will. He said, you don't hear me. I'm never coming to AA again. I said, yes, you will. He said, why do you say that? I said, because after you burn your life to the ground and no one will have anything to do with you, this is all there is. I mean, this is it. So if you're new here, buckle in. The seat, and you have, there's a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous with your name on it. It's been carved in that seat by your failure and your pain and your self-loathing. And your desperation. That seat is the most important seat in the world. Don't let anything or anybody ever take that seat away from you. And here, great things can happen to us. Thanks for listening.